Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth, sitting in for Ann. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services will invest nearly $70 million in Ohio to help combat the opioid crisis. Ohio State will lead a consortium of state universities here at work on the challenges of opioid addiction. Douglas O'Brien is regional director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Douglas.
Good morning, Claire.
So tell us about this consortium. What are they aiming to do?
The Healing Communities Study is a joint venture between the National Institutes of Health and the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, or SAMHSA, which are both constituent agencies of HHS. And what they're doing is they are taking a look now around the country at community-based efforts to combat the opioid crisis. One of the key things that we've learned over the last couple of years is that there isn't a one-size-fits-all DC solution to this crisis. We're seeing incredibly impactful and effective ideas and innovations really coming out of communities all around the country. And Ohio is a great example of that because the opioid crisis has hit Ohio particularly hard. Communities have responded with tremendously innovative and really very aggressive responses. What we want to do is we want to evaluate what is working, how we can help sustain and scale those efforts and spread them around the country to share that impact. And so that money that was directed and is going to be administered through Ohio State University is really going to be looking at community-based efforts around Ohio that are having a tremendous positive impact and how we can use those to better target our resources, not just in Ohio, but everywhere.
That's interesting. So this is $350 million across the country. It's about $66 million here in the state. And basically what you're doing is trying to find teachers in communities that already exist, trying to find like solutions within specific towns and cities and then apply them more broadly?
Right. There are a lot of different ways to attack the opioid crisis. And we understand that there isn't one silver bullet. But in different communities, based upon their needs and their resources, their infrastructure, so many places have come up with innovative solutions that are proving to have beneficial results. Part of our job at the national level is to coordinate those efforts and be able to share what's working. One of the important roles that we have, in addition, a good other example of this, is data. You know, states, localities in the national effort cannot really be focused unless we really understand through data what the problem is, where, when, and how. And by collecting data and aggregating it at a national level, that's another example of how our efforts allow for a greater strategic approach to attacking the opioid crisis.
So does that mean that this work won't necessarily kind of happen within the ivory tower of the university, but the university will be out kind of on the streets doing some shoe leather research here?
Everybody who's involved in combating the opioid crisis, and this is from, you know, the president and Secretary Azar all the way on down, we know that the opioid crisis, the opioid battle, is being fought, and increasingly every day it's being won in church basements, in police stations, in emergency rooms, in living rooms, in community centers. That's where the rubber meets the road. And we've got to get into those locations and see what's working. Already our opioid effort from the national level has been very vertically driven. It's about collaboration with state and local agencies, government agencies, social service agencies, and providers. And the great thing is that there's a tremendous public health infrastructure. And Ohio is actually pretty unique because, as you probably know, Ohio has a unique county-by-county mental health agency in each one of the state's counties. And that's proven to be a really significant resource and asset in Ohio in being able to have local coordination of behavioral health efforts through an entity that's existed for many, many years. It proves to be a real asset.
Well, that leads well into my next question, which is why Ohio got such a significant chunk of this money. Is it purely because we have been hit hardest by the opioid epidemic by some numbers, or is it that we are doing well in combating it?
I think it's likely a combination of both. I think that those two things have a cause and effect relationship, too.
No kidding.
Ohio being hit hard has prompted a tremendous response. You know, the Kasich administration previously and the DeWine administration has picked up right where they left off. Alicia Nelson, who's the director of Recovery Ohio, who came from the Attorney General's office and is now heading up that effort in Governor DeWine's office. We met a couple of weeks ago working on just continuing to enhance our coordination from the federal government to the state government, and then, of course, continuing with local governments, county public health agencies, the county mental health organizations, providers. The Ohio Hospital Association has been a tremendous partner of ours. And I was also in Columbus a number of weeks ago to participate in an event with judges and sheriffs from Ohio to talk about what they're seeing in their local communities. And, you know, I cannot say enough about how local law enforcement has responded to this crisis. Some of the most innovative ideas, some of the greatest passion for innovation and solutions have come from those men and women who are in law enforcement who are really dealing with this in a real face-to-face way every day.
This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth, filling in for Ann. We are talking about the Healing Communities Study, which is funded by a Department of Health and Human Services grant that's coming to Ohio and other states. They are trying to reduce opioid deaths by 40% over 3 years. If you have a question or a comment, call. Give us a call at 614-292-8513. You can also send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. My guest, Douglas O'Brien, Regional Director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Well, I just said 40% over 3 years. That seems like a very high mark to shoot for. How are they going to accomplish this? What does the timeline for it look like?
I think that the goal, while it's ambitious, in the sense that we obviously have far too many opioid-related and drug-related overdoses occurring in this country every day. But there are a couple of things that we've been doing and working through this integrated strategy with our state, local, and community partners that are already having strong impacts. One is doing everything we can to ensure that overdose-reversing medications are widely available.
Like naloxone.
Like naloxone, absolutely. And the FDA actually just approved a new generic nasal naloxone that we think is also going to have a tremendous impact in expanding that access. And what's interesting is that today we're really sort of on a second generation of promoting the utilization of those overdose reversing medications, because at first we wanted to ensure that they were in the hands of providers and first responders. So paramedics, law enforcement officers, emergency rooms, you know, everybody had naloxone and everybody had it at the ready and was trained to use it. And literally around the country, tens of thousands of overdoses have been reversed and countless numbers of lives have been already saved from overdose deaths. But now we're looking at how can we ensure that naloxone is available in the community? Because we have to take that step. We have to ensure that we're doing everything we can to stop that death today. Because you can't talk about recovery, you can't talk about treatment, you can't talk about care for people with substance use disorder after they've died.
Mm.
So, you know, one of the things that we've done is we've promoted working with our states, having standing orders for pharmacies so that they can essentially provide naloxone to any customer who comes in. And, you know, we've been very clear in working with community organizations to promote with family members and with people who are at risk, take that step. Have naloxone, have it in your home, have it accessible. And, you know, that is really taking a quantum leap in how we're approaching this crisis, because the first thing we have to do is we have to reduce that number of 170-some-odd people who are dying every day from drug overdoses.
We've got a call now. David from Columbus has called in. David, you're on the air. What would you like to add to this conversation?
Hi, thank you. I agree with the speaker's ideas. We do need to get better treatment alternatives. However, the number one thing we need is a whole lot more money for more beds and more workers in the field. For example, we talked about the county Adam H. Board. Well, in Franklin County, we're managing to serve roughly 20,000 people each year in mental health and addiction. The need is probably 120,000 people.
Gotcha. Thank you for that comment, David. I think that this is an interesting point, Douglas. We have had so many challenges in looking for innovation solutions. I'm thinking of, for instance, the Ohio Opioid Technology Challenge. At what point do we stop looking for solutions and start sending more money to the solutions that we already have?
We have sent a tremendous amount of funding to the states, obviously, including Ohio. And Ohio has received, over the last couple of years, close to $100 million in state opioid response funding and state targeted response grant funding that has gone directly to the state. That money has then been utilized by the state to fund treatment programs through various providers around the state. It could be at community health centers, it can be hospital-based, it can be other social service agencies. And again, that funding goes through the state because then the state has a great network for allocating those resources according to their infrastructure. So we've seen that as a very effective way to get those dollars into the communities very quickly. In addition, HHS has directly provided a little under $1 billion in direct funding to community health centers, or what we call federally qualified health centers, or FQHCs, around the country, including in Ohio. Deputy Secretary Eric Hargan and I visited one of those in Columbus just last year when we were there attending the Ohio Opioid Summit in Columbus. And, you know, seeing what those community health centers are able to do with those dollars in terms of focusing programming on addiction services is tremendously, tremendously impactful. So those dollars are going into the community as we speak and have been since the beginning of the administration. We've upped our commitment to funding specifically for the opioid crisis by about tenfold since the start of this administration.
Mm. This consortium that is going to take place through the Healing Community Study, it's headed by Ohio State. There's, of course, lots of government agencies, both local and statewide, and other universities. It's targeting 19 counties, and I'm wondering, how are those counties chosen? How did you decide where to focus this sort of effort and where to look for the solutions that you're hoping to take to the national level?
Well, in general, those decisions are based upon a few different factors: the size of the county, the data that we have available on the acuity of the opioid misuse and addiction in those counties, and the infrastructure being in place to be able to effectively utilize those programming dollars. So it's a combination of factors that come into play, but we want to make sure that we're putting resources where they're most needed and where there is the ability to have them create the most positive impact.
Well, and that's an interesting point, because here in Columbus, while we obviously have, in Franklin County more broadly, we've got a very big population, we undoubtedly have a problem with opioids, but we also have a lot of resources compared to some of the more rural areas. And I'm wondering how that urban-rural divide plays out when you're looking at the opioid crisis.
Well, the administration in general has really upped our focus and commitment on rural health issues overall. And one of the things that we've just done, a proposed rule that's just come out, is going to change the way that we calculate reimbursements based upon payment for healthcare workers. It's a pretty convoluted concept, but traditionally we've reimbursed at lower rates in rural areas because of the traditionally lower pay of workers. Well, that had a perverse incentive on diminishing the workforce supply in rural communities and really hurting the ability to deliver services in those areas. And it just didn't make sense. So it's an example of the kind of thing that we're looking to change so that we can make sure that we've got the healthcare resources in rural communities. Another thing that's critically important is making sure we're maximizing the effective use of telehealth. And telepsychiatry and behavioral health through telemedicine is critically important because it can bring access to care to communities where up to now you had virtually no behavioral health care available. So in a lot of communities, that's a tremendous game changer because an individual can stay in their community, can be, you know, in this case, in the case of something like substance use disorder, they can continue to get the kind of counseling that they need. They can stay in their community, they can continue to work, and they can access care that would never have been available in their community without the use of technology.
Before I let you go, we've only got a few moments left, but I did want to mention that, you know, the National Prescription Drug Takeback Day is this Saturday. It's April 27th. What is that day? Why is it important? You know, why can't we just get rid of our prescription drugs in the trash or by flushing them down a toilet?
No, don't say that.
Don't even say that. Well, please educate me. Educate me. That's why you're here.
Well, Takeback Day is about a 10-year-old idea, and literally millions of pounds of medications have been disposed of properly thanks to Drug Takeback Day. The idea really started because, you know, in the same way that we've changed the way we look at disposing of things like batteries and, you know, motor oil, if you change the oil in your car, you don't just dump it down the storm sewer. You don't just put it in the trash. These are items and medications need to be disposed of in an environmentally sound and responsible way. So really, that's where the whole idea started. But now it becomes even more important in the face of this opioid crisis, because one of the things that we know is that a very significant percentage of people who are struggling with opioid substance use disorder misused prescription medications first. And that could be something that a family member had that they took and misused, or something that they got their hands on, but it was a legal prescription for somebody originally, and it sat in a medicine cabinet, and it got diverted one way or another and got into the illicit supply. So our data, and this goes back to what I was saying before about how data helps us understand this, so we're appealing to everybody, not just because it's the right thing to do to get all those medications, prescription, over-the-counter, everything, get it, dispose of it properly, go to DEATakeback.com to find a location near you, get those medicines disposed of properly, but particularly look for those pain medications. Mm. Get those out of your medicine cabinet. You know, if you need them, you can get another prescription. But, you know, a lot of people think, oh, I'm just going to hang on to these for a rainy day. It's a bad idea for two reasons. One is it can get diverted into the illicit supply, which is bad for everybody. But the other thing is expired medications don't do you a lot of good. They can do you a lot of harm. So don't look at it that way. Please, everybody, Take Back Days this Saturday. Go through your medicine cabinet and responsibly dispose of all those medicines that you're not needing right now.
Douglas O'Brien, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you, Claire. Have a great day.
Absolutely. Douglas O'Brien is the regional director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. They're investing nearly $70 million in Ohio to help combat the opioid crisis. Find out more about that on our website, wosu.org/allsides. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth, filling in for Ann. Coming up, we're talking about colorectal cancer. If you'd like to join the conversation, feel free to call 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth, filling in for Ann this hour. Colorectal cancer rates in adults over the age of 50 have been falling since the mid-80s, but that's not the case for young adults. New research shows that both the incidence and the death rate of colorectal cancer is increasing for people under 50. Research and outreach director of the Colorectal Cancer Prevention Network at University of Southern South Carolina, Franklin Berger, recently wrote about the issue for The Conversation. You can find a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And Franklin Berger joins us now by phone. Thanks for joining the program, Franklin.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So just to start at the beginning, tell us about the colon. What does it do? Why do we need it?
Well, the colon is the last stage of your digestive system, which processes, removes water from the digestive waste and produces the waste that you expel when you have a bowel movement. So it's very, very important. It's a very large organ, and it does a very, very important job in your physiology.
I feel like we hear a lot about colon cancer. Is that the same as colorectal cancer, or are they different?
Well, they are slightly different. Colorectal cancer refers to collectively cancers of the colon and the rectum, which is at the end of the colon.
Mm.
So some people will separate colon cancer from rectal cancer. They're slightly different in their structures and in their roles. And other people will collectively call it colorectal cancer. But basically, we're talking about the same thing. So
gotcha.
When we talk, mainly talked about colorectal cancer collectively, colon and the rectum.
Kind of like a square rectangle situation. Typically,
correct,
it's older adults who are diagnosed. So why are we seeing this increase in younger populations?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. As you indicated, people over 50 who have been undergoing screening, and we've been promoting screening for quite some time now, the incidences and deaths from colorectal cancer are decreasing. But in people under 50 for whom screening has not traditionally been recommended, the rates are going up. And we do not know why. And that's a major source of research efforts right now, is to try to understand what's going on in younger people who are showing or displaying increased rates of colorectal cancer, including people in their 20s and 30s who previously were very rare. Now it's becoming more common. It's still relatively, people under 50, it's still only about 10 to 12% of the overall colon cancer incidences and deaths, but it's increasing. And it's increasing at a rate that's got a lot of people in the public health community concerned.
Mm. In general, what do we know about what causes colorectal cancer, regardless of age?
Well, colorectal cancer is a complicated intersection of a number of factors, including genetic factors, including lifestyle factors such as diet, such as alcohol, such as smoking, and all those things intersect to promote the development of colorectal cancer. When you think about it, the lining of your gastrointestinal tract, including the colon, is constantly in contact with the environment, because you have things that you eat and food that are being processed going through your gastrointestinal tract, including the colon. And so the lining of the colon is very susceptible to those things that are taken in your diet. So it's a very complicated contribution from a number of factors, including genetic factors.
Mm. As you mentioned, the colon is part of the digestive system. So does diet play any sort of larger role in this sort of cancer than in any other?
Diet has a role in a number of cancers. It has a very profound role in colorectal cancer. And so for a long time, the diets, the sugar-based diets with a lot of the additives that are going into the foods we're taking in that are increasing have been of concern to epidemiologists and biologists who are studying the origin of colorectal cancer. And so colorectal cancer is a profound example of the impact of diet on the development of cancer.
Mm. You're finding that more young people are being diagnosed with this cancer than before. Is there anything to watch out for? Any warning signs that younger people should keep their eyes out for?
Yes. So while research is going on, trying to understand the origin of the increase in colorectal cancer in younger people, this is going to take some time, as I indicated in my article. What we're doing now in the meantime is we're trying to make people aware, young people and primary care physicians are trying to make them aware of colorectal cancer and the symptoms, which include any kind of bleeding, blood in the stool that occurs for a long time and that is very visible, cramping that occurs chronically over a long period of time, changes in the structure of the stool, prolonged periods of constipation or diarrhea. Those are the kinds of things people need to be aware of and look out for. We're not trying to induce panic in young people. It's still a low-frequency disease, but because it's on the increase, we want people to be aware, and we want physicians to be aware, because the other thing we're finding is that many young people who have symptoms, their physicians think, well, you're too young to have colorectal cancer, so it must be something else, and they send them through a whole battery of tests, avoiding or not ordering in a timely manner a colonoscopy to determine if there is a lesion there that's at the source of some of these symptoms. So many young people are diagnosed at a more advanced stage of colorectal cancer. And this is what made me impassioned about this disease, because I met a number of people in their 20s and 30s with colorectal cancer, and they were angry, they were resentful, they felt like they were dismissed and they were diagnosed too late. So we're trying to make not only young people, but parents of young people and physicians aware of this trend, so that if they do show some of these symptoms, they're attended to in a timely manner.
I was going to say, it sounds like this is something that needs to happen in the education of the medical community as well.
Absolutely. And as part of our program here in South Carolina, we're on a targeted campaign to educate primary care physicians and family physicians who see young people with symptoms so that they're aware and can act appropriately.
Keeping that in mind, what sort of questions should patients ask about this type of cancer, you know, during their regular checkups?
So we're encouraging very young people to be aware of their family histories, talk to their parents, talk to their grandparents about whether or not there's colorectal cancer or other cancers in the family. But the main thing to talk about with your physician is the presence of any symptoms that may be indicative of a colon cancer, so that it can be diagnosed. Because the earlier colon cancer is diagnosed, the better is the prognosis for preventing an advanced disease that could be lethal.
Yeah.
Colorectal cancer is one of the primary cancers that can be prevented by a colonoscopy and other tests that are being developed now. And so it's a highly preventable cancer. And so we're trying to make young people and their physicians and their parents and their grandparents aware so that the prevention can occur in a timely manner.
So it's really about catching it early.
Exactly. Exactly.
Other than age, are there factors that put some people at higher risk?
Yeah, as I said earlier, things like diet, diets rich in sugar and refined foods, alcohol, smoking, all of these can contribute to colorectal cancer. But the interesting thing is that amongst young people, what we're finding, what physicians will tell you, is that the patients that I am seeing in their 20s, 30s, and 40s with colorectal cancer, many of them are thin, fit, active. So there's clearly, as I indicated in my article, clearly something else going on besides the traditional, or in addition to the traditional factors that are warnings of colorectal cancer or predispose to the possibility of colorectal cancer. And that's where research comes in. We're trying to find out what those factors are that are causing even young, fit, active people who exercise regularly to come down with colorectal cancer when they're in their 30s and 40s.
Is there are there preventative measures that we can take? It sounds like watching your diet is one of them, but as you said, it seems like there's kind of a big question mark right now.
Well, there are, because colorectal cancer is multifactorial. There are a lot of factors that go into it, and the disease is very heterogeneous. The specific location, the nature of the disease, the ability of a person to respond to therapies can vary a lot. So there's a tremendous amount of variation amongst patients, amongst the cancers, amongst colorectal cancers. And so a one-size-fits-all does not necessarily apply. But it is important, as we said, to be aware of diet, to be aware of alcohol use, to be aware of smoking. Those are key factors that we want to promote for a healthy life, including a life free of colorectal cancer.
Before we let you go, is there anything else that research tells us about this type of cancer? Anything else that we need to be keeping in mind as we are aware of this trend and as we're kind of trying to stay vigilant?
The most important thing to be aware of with regard to this trend is to know your family histories, because a family history of colorectal cancer puts an individual at a higher risk, and to be aware of your symptoms. If you have any changes in bowel habits, any changes in severe and cramping in the abdominal area, to be aware of those things and to seek the advice of a physician as soon as possible.
Well, Franklin Berger, thank you.
Oh, family history is extremely important. Family histories are very important in all of this.
Franklin Berger, thank you so much for joining the program today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Franklin Berger is the Director of Research and Outreach of the Colorectal Cancer Prevention Network at the University of South Carolina. He wrote about this issue for The Conversation. Find a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth, filling in for Ann. We're talking about workplace wellness programs coming up after the break. If you participate in one, if you've got questions about them, feel free to join the conversation. The number is 614-292-8513, or you can email us. We're at allsides@wosu.org, and we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth, filling in for Ann. Workplace wellness programs are an $8 billion industry in the United States. The programs are common, especially in large companies that see them as vehicles to improve workers' health and lower overall medical spending. A new study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, might make employers rethink that strategy. Physician and health economist of health policy at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Zuri Song, is the lead author of that study, and they join us now. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Claire. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So let's just define what a workplace wellness program is before we talk about their efficacy.
Sure. Workplace wellness programs are efforts invested in by employers or put on by employers to try to improve the health and productivity of their employees, often with a goal of improving the morale, the culture, and ultimately with the hope of slowing the growth of healthcare costs among the workforce.
So what does it actually look like? Is it an app? Is it fitness trackers? Is it a gym that's offered? How does it function in the real world?
That's a great question. Workplace wellness programs come in many shapes and forms. They typically include a personal health assessment that asks the employee various questions about health behaviors, knowledge of their health conditions, or plans about improving their health. and that is used to identify areas of potential improvement. They also include various interventions or efforts to improve physical activity, to improve aspects of nutrition, such as healthy eating or ways to cook healthier foods. And they contain often advice on smoking cessation, stress reduction, as well as efforts to bring people together into group activities. But it depends on the employer. It depends on the setting.
Sure. So presumably this is offered almost for free to employees. Is that the way that it usually works?
Typically, these programs are offered on a voluntary basis.
Okay.
Employees can join them whenever they wish or exit whenever they wish. And there are typically incentives attached to participation as well. Now, these incentives do vary across programs. The size of the incentives vary, whether they are so-called carrots or sticks, often varies across employers as well. But typically, participation is entirely voluntary.
Well, and Ohio State has a program like this, and I know that the rewards are given not from youth necessarily completing a goal, but just from participation. Is that normal, or is it, oh, if you lose X pounds, we're going to incentivize this for you?
That's also a great question. The threshold for obtaining rewards or receiving an incentive does vary across programs and employers. It's difficult to generalize, but often we do hear anecdotal evidence of participation being used as the metric for receiving incentives rather than a hard outcome, if you will, at the end of a program or at the end of participation.
So why are workplaces offering this? Presumably, it's not out of the goodness of their hearts.
Well, I don't know that we can entirely presume that, to be fair to the employers.
Okay.
There are many reasons that employers may offer wellness programs. As we know in health policy in general, private firms as well as public employers in the U.S. Have for years struggled with containing healthcare costs among their employees. The growth of healthcare costs is often one of the biggest costs that employers face in trying to balance their books. And so healthcare costs is certainly a common motivation for investing in a wellness program. But there are additional non-financial motivations as well, including improving the productivity of their employees, improving workplace culture or morale, improving various aspects of unobservable or sometimes intangible dimensions of wellness that might contribute to a particular employee or type of worker performing better in the workplace. There's also an element of competition for talent among employers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd imagine that employers offering wellness programs might allow them to attract better talent in the labor market.
I'm speaking with Dr. Zuri Song. He's a physician and health economist of health policy at Harvard Medical School. And he's published a study that may get employers rethinking their strategy of offering workplace wellness programs. And I'd love for you to tell me a little bit about your study. What were you looking at and what did you find?
Sure, I'd be happy to. We looked at the effect of a workplace wellness program that was implemented across multiple work sites in the eastern United States within a large employer. And we used the study design of a randomized controlled trial that allowed us to more rigorously test the effects of this program relative to much of the prior literature on workplace wellness programs. At the end of 18 months for this particular study, we found that the workplace wellness program resulted in greater rates of some positive health behaviors, notably increased rates of regular exercise and actively managing weight among employees that worked in workplaces randomly selected to receive the program compared to employees who worked in other work sites that did not receive the program. However, at the end of 18 months, there were no significant differences in clinical measures of health, such as blood pressure, weight, and cholesterol. There were no differences in healthcare spending or utilization that were significant. And there were no differences in employment outcomes, such as absenteeism and job performance at the 18-month mark.
That's interesting. So it was good in some ways, especially for the employees, but the metrics might not have changed on the employer side?
It depends on what that employer cares about. This is a bit of a nuanced point, but you might imagine that some employers care a lot about health behavior change, more so than changes in healthcare costs or other objective measures in the short run. You might imagine other employers who care a lot about lowering healthcare costs, more so than changes in health behaviors. And these different types of employers might view the results in different ways. Whether or not the effects were just good for the employers depends on your interpretation of just good for the employees, rather, depends on your interpretation of what the employers value. But certainly we saw that health behaviors did respond to the wellness program. And if you believe that health behaviors must change first before changes in objective health outcomes and before changes in healthcare costs, then you might interpret this as a first step towards changing some of these more objective outcomes that employers might care about more uniformly. But there are other ways to think about the results, too, and I'd be happy to go into that with you further.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious how your research kind of fits in the broader context of the studies that have already been done about these sorts of programs. How much do we know about their efficacy overall?
Well, that's a great question, Claire. There have been a couple of decades, if not more, of various studies that have tried to inform this field of workplace wellness and that have tried to guide employer and public policy decisions about investments in workplace wellness. By and large, the majority of those studies have been observational in design, meaning that they did not use a randomized control trial type of approach to study the effect of workplace wellness programs. And because of that, they are more susceptible to some of the biases that would make us concerned about how much to read into or believe those prior results. For example, it's rather commonly known that workers who might have a predisposed affinity towards wellness programs or towards healthy living, health behaviors, and otherwise taking care of their health in various ways might be more predisposed to join a voluntary wellness program. And thus, the differences you might see at the end of the day between participants and non-participants might be more of a reflection of people's baseline inherent willingness to improve their health rather than actual program effects themselves. So in this study, we tried to use a study design that was more rigorous than the typical observational design, i.e. the randomized trial, to tease that off, to tease that selection bias out and to try to study the effects of this program independent of the selection effects of people voluntarily joining.
Given that you had, I don't want to say better data, but perhaps more data and more rigorously segmented data, what else did you find interesting about the results of your study?
Well, one of the things that interested us was that amongst health behaviors, some improved and some did not, that there was heterogeneity within the overall category of health behaviors that we studied. It also interested us that many of the other objective measures did not show differences at the 18-month mark. It further motivates us to study this area, and we are planning on and currently beginning to undertake a follow-up study out to 3 years that will hopefully teach us more about the effects of this program using this particular rigorous design.
So how long had you done it before?
This particular study was at the 18-month mark.
Oh, 18 months. So it'll be the same design, but extended out to 3 years.
Correct.
I know scientists hate to speculate. I know that is not in your nature. But is there anything that you expect to find as you go through the next 3 years and as you kind of extrapolate out?
Well, it's a really good question. I think one of the key areas of interest heading into the follow-up study is whether these health behavior improvements or health behavior differences between the treatment work sites and the control work sites at 18 months do translate into changes in objective measures of health or changes in healthcare costs at 3 years. And one of the ways to interpret our current results is that 18 months might be too short of a time, as you alluded to earlier, for health behaviors to translate into improvements or changes in these objective measures of health or healthcare costs down the road. Another way to think about it potentially is that short-run effects on healthcare costs or objective measures of health may have reverted back to baseline at 18 months, and that we must leave open the possibility that potentially the program had an effect early on, but by 18 months, the program's effects may have dissipated to a point where we could not tell a statistical difference between the work sites that received the program and the work sites that did not. So at 3 years, we will have a better sense of which explanation may dominate in the way that we interpret these results.
That's really fascinating because, as you mentioned earlier, you found it affected some things but not others. And what you found it affected was behavior, right? And it just didn't get
right.
to the numbers of the biometric numbers, if you will. And perhaps it
right.
will impact that down the line because behaviors take a while to have an impact on our health.
Correct. And perhaps. I agree with you. We just don't know at this point.
I've been really focusing on the employer side of this, but how do you feel these results, what do you think that they say to those employees out there that might be weighing the benefits and the costs of participating in one of these programs?
Well, it's a wonderful question, Claire. I'm glad that we can talk about the employee side a little bit. From what we heard on the ground, the anecdotal evidence that we collected, this wellness program was rather well received by employees. We heard stories of employees engaging with the program quite positively. The program, for example, had a registered dietitian on site at the workplaces who conducted and coordinated the program for the employees, often working with them in groups or sometimes individually, doing cooking demonstrations, education sessions about sugar and fat content in various types of foods, to leading group activities that centered on physical activity. Exercise in the workplace, break rooms, or outside of the workplace. So there were various elements of personal engagement with the employees that were quite well received, and we have testimonials sent to us by our registered dietitians or the employees speaking about their personal experiences in the program. So that's an element of this that obviously is meaningful, and to the extent that that informs other employees' decisions to participate, I would say that it's a small, meaningful data point that in this particular experience, in this particular randomized trial, the participants seem to have felt quite positively about the program, despite however you might interpret the statistical results that we reported. And more broadly, like we mentioned earlier, most workplace wellness programs are voluntary in nature in terms of participation. So this is a choice. It is often and ought to be centered on the freedom of participation exit on the part of the employees.
One last question before we have to go. You know, this show is a testament to how many opinions are out there about what constitutes wellness. Are the building blocks of these programs across big and small companies, are they all essentially the same or do they differ a little bit?
Evidence suggests that they do differ a little bit. They have some common components, such as the personal health assessment, which is a survey in most instances, and a focus on nutrition and physical activity and stress reduction seems to be common across many of the programs. But they do differ in their intensity, in their duration, in their approach, and certainly in geography and the vendors that put on these programs in the work sites.
Dr. Zuri Song, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Zuri Song is a physician and economist of health policy at Harvard Medical School. He published a study on workplace wellness programs last week. You've been listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth, filling in for Ann today. You can find more of our show at our website, wosu.org/allsides. Special thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, interns Ray Brewster, Maisie Glockner, and Sophie Warner. Have a great day.